Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
Today on Maine Calling, what your elected officials did and did not do in the legislative session that just ended. State lawmakers passed a number of measures this spring, including a series of bills supporters say are designed to enhance gun safety. They did not pass a so-called red flag law, however, as many advocates were calling for in the wake of the Lewiston shootings in October. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll assess the list of achievements cited by Democratic and Republican leaders in Augusta, and speak with our Political Pulse team about some of the most high-profile issues that emerged during the session. We'll also explore some of the proposals that never made it to the governor's desk, and why, and about what we can expect for the next session in January. Some perspective on the legislative session. Maine Calling is coming right up. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Well, it came down to the wire, but the legislature finished its business, most of it anyway, early Thursday morning. Today I'm joined by a panel of journalists who will assess what was and wasn't accomplished and to answer your questions. Steve Missler is the chief politics and government correspondent for Maine Public. Kevin Miller is Maine Public's State House correspondent, and Susan Cover is a digital journalist with Spectrum News Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Susan will bring you in first. Welcome. What will you, you've covered, I'm sure, many of these sessions, and I'm sure they're all memorable. What do you think this one will be remembered for among reporters?
Well, I think although the session officially started in January, really the overarching theme started in October with the Lewiston mass shootings. And I think the legislature's reaction to that, the governor's reaction to that, and what the people called for by showing up early in the session by the hundreds to demand action and gun control measures, I think will be, you know, really the overarching theme of this legislative session.
And we're going to get into some of the specifics about what happened and didn't happen along those lines. But Steve, before we get into that, the governor signed, Governor Mills signed into law the supplemental budget that lawmakers approved last week. It's not a lot of money, but it contains kind of it's a bit of a grab bag of spending for all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, Keith, the governor signed the supplemental budget yesterday, which is about $127 million in new appropriations. That includes money for public education, substance abuse disorder, and housing initiatives, which has been a big priority for this particular legislature. And of course, the supplemental budget is basically a change to the state's current two-year budget. I think that gets lost in some of the terminology up here, but effectively, what it does is just alter the two-year budget that's in place. And I think, you know, something like 20% of the spending package is directed to Maine Housing for programs that it administers. And of course, the political drama associated with this spending package sort of gave the impression that it was this massive change to the state budget, but it's really not. You know, the state budget is $10.5 billion. So we're not talking about a lot of money in that context. But of course, you wouldn't know it if you judged it solely on all the maneuvering and the standoffs the spending package created during the last couple weeks of the session.
Yeah. Kevin, as Susan mentioned, this is the session after the Lewiston shootings. And of course, lawmakers did approve some gun safety measures, background checks, a waiting period. And and also a ban on bump stocks. So let's get into that and talk about each one of them, maybe starting with the background check bill.
Yeah, so this would require private gun sellers who advertise either in print, in a print publication like Uncle Henry's, or in one of these many online gun marketplaces, they would have to run a background check on potential buyers. And they would basically have to go to a federally licensed gun dealer and ask them to run that background check for them. This aims to get at this huge, really unregulated person-to-person gun marketplace that we have here in Maine. But at the same time, this isn't a universal background check because it would only apply to private sales that are advertised. And it also you wouldn't have to run a background check if you're selling or transferring a gun to your friends or your family or your hunting buddy.
And yeah, which is how a lot of these things happen. So the waiting period, this is a 72-hour waiting period. Can you just explain how it works?
Yeah, exactly. This would be a 72-hour waiting period on the purchase of firearms. So this was largely talked about as a way to potentially reduce the likelihood of suicide by kind of providing a cooling off period, if you will, in hopes that someone might reconsider or get help during that time period, because there have been multiple incidents here in Maine where you have people that have gone, purchased the firearm, and then immediately or soon thereafter ended their life. This is also looked at as a way to potentially cut down on gun crimes. But again, this also would not apply to sales or transfers between family members, and it also wouldn't apply to law enforcement.
And the third was, as we mentioned, a ban on bump stocks and other rapid fire devices. These are sort of modifications that can be made to weapons. Can you explain that?
Sure. So bump stocks, they're one kind of these mechanical devices that allows you to turn a semi-automatic gun into something like a machine gun, where it fires repeatedly and rapidly by keeping the trigger depressed. There are also electronic rapid-fire modifications. Those would also be banned under this. There have been a number of mass shootings. I think the most notable is the one in Las Vegas back in 2017, where I think almost 60 people were killed, where the gunman used these bump stocks or other modifying devices. The Trump administration, after that shooting, did the ATF did ban bump stocks, but that case is now before the Supreme Court. And the argument here is that if the Supreme Court should overturn the federal ban, that states should have their own laws in place.
And do we have this is sort of the signing season when the governor signs or doesn't sign or whatever on some of these bills. Do we have a sense of how those might fare?
Yeah, that's right. So we know the governor will sign, if she hasn't already done so, her bill to expand background checks to private sales. And that bill would also tweak Maine's yellow flag gun confiscation law. Maybe we can get into that as well a bit later. But she hasn't said whether she'll sign or veto the 72-hour waiting period or the bump stocks ban. Gun groups like the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine and the NRA, they oppose those bills. They're advocating for the governor to veto them. She could also allow those bills to become law without her signature, which is one way here in Maine where governors can basically go along with the majority will of the legislature without actually endorsing the policy behind it. So she has 10 days to do that from the end of the session. So those days are now ticking by.
So by not signing it, it's sort of a statement that gives her some political cover, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she wouldn't be putting her name to it, but at the same time, she'd be allowing it to go into law.
So in this section, we're talking about things that got done. We will talk about what didn't get done later, but we have to mention, Steve, that while we're talking about what got done on the gun front, we should mention that what did not get done here was the proposed red flag law. And just remind us here, Maine has a yellow flag law. Just explain what a red flag law is, how it's different, and then what happened, I guess, to that proposal.
Sure. So the red flag basically gives families, in addition to law enforcement, the ability to restrict a person's access to firearms without the need for a mental health evaluation. The yellow flag law that you mentioned that we currently have, and we're the only state in the nation that has one of these, essentially calls, it allows law enforcement to initiate the process of confiscating a gun, somebody's gun, if they're deemed a risk to themselves or others. But that whole confiscation hinges on a mental health evaluation. And so I think supporters of that law believe that it affords more due process to a person who may have their weapon seized. But for people who support red flag, it's a bit of a barrier in the sense that it doesn't allow family members to initiate that process on their own. And there's the belief that some families that are confronted with this situation may be reluctant to approach law enforcement for various reasons. You know, maybe they don't want to get their loved one in trouble. And that this would be a better way and to prevent something terrible from happening. As you mentioned, it did not pass. It was introduced very late in the session, which I was surprised at personally. But I think I underestimated how protective some decision makers in the state house are of Maine's current yellow flag law, which was actually born out of a previous red flag proposal in 2019. Basically, gun rights groups like the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, the governor's office, and lawmakers got together and basically came up with the yellow flag law as a sort of compromise. But that compromise is, you know, there's a lot of pride of ownership in that compromise. And I think that's something that loomed large this session. And I have no doubt that it affected the outcome of this year's red flag bill, which got to committee. There was two public hearings on it, actually, in a work session. It passed out of committee, but it never made it to a vote on either the House or the Senate. It was not in the governor's gun safety proposals, which, as Kevin mentioned, you know, was included a tweak to the yellow flag law. And it wasn't in the legislative Democrats' original slate of bills either. And you can make a pretty strong argument that it was the one measure most relevant to the Lewiston shootings. Yet, again, it was rolled out pretty late and they didn't bother to vote on it. So, you know, it may have been this year, may have been the last best chance to pass such a proposal in Maine, but they didn't bring it up for a vote. And perhaps Kevin, who was here some of those late hours, might have some insight into why.
Yeah, I guess it just seemed that was the official explanation, is they didn't have time to bring it up. But I suspect that there was quite a bit of vote counting going on at the same time. And as Steve mentioned, there was a lot of seemed to be protective attitude towards the yellow flag law, because leading up to the Lewiston shootings, the yellow flag law wasn't used that often. But since that time, it's been used quite a bit. And so the supporters of the law say, look, it works. It would have potentially worked in Lewiston had the police been willing to use it.
Yeah, so Susan, that was the argument, I guess, for those who didn't want to go to red flag, was saying, hey, we have a yellow flag law. It should have worked had it been applied in this case. And so that's what we should focus on.
Yeah, exactly. And, the speaker did put out a statement the day after session when we asked, why didn't you bring it up? It was her bill. Certainly as speaker, she has the power to control what comes to the floor. And she indicated that she's running for the Senate, and if she gets elected there, that we're going to see this come back in future years. So this isn't the end of the story, I think, with regard to the red flag law.
And what was also interesting is we had this investigating commission, the special commission, holding meetings and grilling the people who were surrounded this shooting all the while these debates were happening. So as Steve mentioned, Susan, would have been the best opportunity to pass a red flag law, or not, or it might still have a chance down the road?
Oh, I think there's still a chance down the road. You know, the interesting thing, you mentioned the Lewiston Independent Commission and their interim report. They didn't call for major changes to the yellow flag law or bringing forward a red flag law. And we're still waiting, of course, on their final report. But I think as more time passes and they are able to do a more thorough investigation, we're going to get a better idea moving forward with what they might recommend. And Also, I think, it's not even 6 months from the shootings. Milestone, I guess, is coming up this week. And I think with the passage of time and some more clarity, it might provide a pathway forward for what we need to do and maybe what we don't need to do.
Yeah, that was interesting, too. You mentioned the independent commission. The timing of that interim report was, I think, also had some effect on how the red flag proposal, which actually hadn't even come out as a bill yet. So the interim report came out, as Sue mentioned. It didn't recommend any changes to the yellow flag process or proposal. It just said that it should have been used. And I think that was an argument that opponents of the red flag law had been using and stating ever since the October tragedy. And so in some ways, the interim report kind of bolstered that argument. I remember the Republicans coming out and holding a press conference saying exactly that, that the interim report proved that they were correct. And so I don't know how much of that sort of sentiment bled into the Democratic side of the calculation here, but it was certainly a factor, I think, just in the whole rhetorical debate about that particular proposal.
Lawmakers did pass a ban on paramilitary training camps. Steve, this was a proposal introduced in response to a prominent neo-Nazi group that had been building a facility in northern Maine last year. Just talk about that proposal and why proponents believed it was needed.
Yeah, I think there was a reaction. It was like, as you say, it was a reaction to this prominent neo-Nazi group that had been starting to build a training facility in Springfield, and that got a lot of attention, and I think drew a lot of outrage and disgust and that sort of thing, and that prompted a lot of discussion about what could be done to make sure that these people can't set up shop here. And that's how we ended up with the proposal that ended up becoming law. And it basically gives police and prosecutors more tools to prevent militias from setting up new operations in the future. And, this neo-Nazi group has already pulled up stakes. It's not here any longer. It's abandoned its plans to create this training camp in Maine. But the idea behind passing this law was to basically prevent future operations from coming here. Republicans voted, I think, almost as a block to oppose the bill. And there were some, maybe a handful of Democrats who were opposed to it as well. And they argued that it was unnecessary and that it might infringe on free speech as well as peaceful gatherings of people whose views may be out of step with the popular beliefs or government officials. So, that was the central tension in the debate. But ultimately, the governor signed the bill, and it is law. We'll have to just wait and see if it'll ever actually be utilized in the future.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall, and today I have three journalists who cover the State House. We're discussing the just-completed legislative session. Two of my Maine public colleagues are here, Kevin Miller, our State House correspondent, and Steve Missler, chief politics and government correspondent. And Susan Cover is with Spectrum News Maine. She's a digital journalist. Join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Kristen Cloutier. She's the assistant majority leader for Maine's House of Representatives. She's a Democrat from Lewiston. Representative Cloutier, thank you for joining.
Thanks so much for having me.
What would you say is the most important accomplishment this session?
Well, being the representative or one of the representatives from Lewiston, I am really proud of the work we were able to do around gun safety. House Democrats have been unwavering in our belief that doing nothing to improve gun safety in the wake of that tragedy was not an option. And so we were able to deliver on our promises to the people of Maine by sending three bills to the governor's desk last week. And those include a bill that would close the background check loophole for advertised gun sales, establish a 72-hour waiting period for firearms purchases, banning bump stocks, and then also invest in our mental and public health infrastructure. So we heard loud and clear from mayors across the state that they wanted meaningful action to make our community safer from violence, and I'm proud that we were able to deliver on that.
On that front or any other, was there any proposal that you would have liked to have seen pass that did not?
You know, for me, I think what was most disappointing was that we weren't able to get the votes we needed for the reproductive autonomy amendment, which was LD 780. I feel like we really missed an opportunity to send the question about whether reproductive rights should be enshrined in the Constitution to the voters so that they could decide whether or not they thought that was an action we should take.
Hmm. Steve, did you have a question for the rep?
Yeah, I guess my question, Representative Cloutier, is about the abortion constitutional amendment. What efforts, if any, were there to try to get Republicans on board with that particular proposal? I mean, in general, I think Republicans have voted against any sort of expansion or enshrining of abortion protections. I guess, you know, was there any effort to try to bring any of the GOP along on that? Because that's what you needed in order to advance that proposal to voters for its ultimate ratification.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Steve. I was not the bill sponsor, so I can't speak to what efforts were made on behalf of Senator Vitale. They did get the two-thirds that they needed in the Senate. And I do think that the fact that this was a bill that would send it out to referendum so that voters had the opportunity to voice their opinions, I think made some of us feel a little bit more hopeful about getting it across the finish line, because it was putting the question into the hands of the voters as opposed to allowing legislators to make that decision for folks.
What do you say would be your priorities? I know we've only just finished this, but what would be the caucus's priorities or your priorities for the next session?
So, you know, the priorities for House Democrats tend to be pretty consistent, I would say. We're focused on improving housing affordability and accessibility, increasing the affordability and accessibility of childcare, and then building an economy that works for all Mainers. And so I think that really, what that looks like in practice is really sort of a caregiving continuum is what I like to describe it as. So how we're supporting folks who are looking to raise their families here. So they need access to childcare and they need access to affordable childcare. How we're expanding options for that, how we're expanding healthcare options for folks at the other end of the spectrum. So allowing for and supporting caregiving for folks who are at the end of their life, and then really everything in between. I think it's important for us to create a state that supports people throughout the continuum of their lives. And I think we, you know, were able to make some significant progress on that by passing and funding and instituting the a statewide paid family and medical leave program last year. But I think overall, we're still not where we need to be, and we have a lot more work to do. And I think by doing all of these things, we're also sort of helping to fill the workforce gap that we've been seeing in recent years.
Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, just one more question, Representative Cloutier, since we were just talking about it, and it's about the red flag proposal, which I believe you were a co-sponsor of. Of course, as you mentioned when you introduced yourself, you are one of the members of the Lewiston delegation. I guess, can you give us any insight into what happened with that proposal? It came out late, as you know. And it never came up for a vote. Was it because there wasn't enough support to pass it, or was there some other consideration as to why that proposal didn't advance any further than out of committee?
Yeah, sorry, Steve. So I think you and I had talked about this once before, and it was before we introduced the red flag law. Our judiciary committee had heard repeatedly over the course of the public hearing on the other gun bills that Mainers were really looking for us to introduce a red flag law. And so, as you said, we did so, but very late in the session. And the truth of the matter is that we just kind of ran out of time. As you know, we didn't get out of the state house until 6 o'clock in the morning last Thursday. And unfortunately, this was one of the things that we ended up having to sacrifice in the end because we didn't have time to finish all of the work that we had in front of us.
Kristen Cloutier, House Assistant Majority Leader, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Now let's head across the proverbial aisle, and we are joined by Billy Bob Falkingham. He's the House Minority Leader, a Republican from Winter Harbor. Representative Falkingham, thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
I'll ask start with the same question that I asked your colleague, which was, what did you see as the most significant accomplishment of this past session?
Oh, accomplishments. Well, we had some, but it was disappointing to see the Democrats try to roll them back. You know, Republicans really went into this legislature trying to lower taxes and lower energy costs. Those were two of our top priorities. And it became clear in the first session that those things were not going to happen with Democrats in control. So we didn't give up on those things, but we sort of shifted focus to some other things to say, what are things that the people of Maine support that we also support? And a couple of things we landed on were transportation, our roads and bridges. The people of Maine, everybody, no matter what part of the political spectrum you come from, wants good roads and bridges. They want a good transportation system. So that was one of our priorities. We worked on that. We got a bipartisan majority report to fund that in the Transportation Committee. We ended up getting that through. And another thing we ended up getting through in the first session was pension tax relief for our seniors. And those were two big successes of this legislature. Unfortunately, I feel like the Democrats were bitter that there were some things that Republicans actually supported. And that was what you saw a few Saturdays back. If you remember all the big news from the 3 a.m. appropriations meeting, unbelievably, it was the Democrats on the Appropriations Committee that went after seniors' pensions, that went after the transportation budget. And on top of that, went after the liquor fund, went after several other things in the middle of the night. And but the backlash from the public was very severe, and they rolled back some of that. Unfortunately, they still diverted $11 million from the transportation budget, which could cost the state of Maine as much as $30 or $40 million in matching funds because that was done. So I'm glad that pension tax deduction was put in there. That was a bill that I introduced in the legislature last session. We got that added into the budget. It remained in there. We're very proud of the work that the Transportation Committee did. Bipartisan, by the way. There were some key Democrats on that Transportation Committee that joined and had the support of the governor. And that's really what, you know, good bipartisan work should look like. You should be proud of that, not bitter about it and try to roll it back because you feel like the other side actually played a role in the legislature and had some accomplishments.
Aside from the spending issues that you just raised, was there any piece of legislation that did not pass that you wish had gotten more support?
Well, like I said, we really wanted to see some significant and structural tax relief done. We weren't able to do that. We did get money back to the people through the energy relief bill, but it's not something we wanted to stick with. We basically thought it was the best we could get, and it got money back to people. It got money in people's hands, but it was on a one-time basis, and we really worked hard in the taxation committee and with Democrats trying to get some sort of structural tax relief. And we were, you know, focused on lower and middle income people. Unfortunately, we just never could get there on that. But, you know, really, I'd say our one of our biggest focuses and biggest goals was to try to lower energy costs. And we had a bill in that would have done just that. It was a bill to lower energy rates, which would have tackled this problem that we have with net energy billing, which is, for people that don't know what that is, it's basically all these solar fields that you're seeing going up in the farm, you know, occupying farm fields or forests getting mowed down and replaced by solar panels. That's not just because the property owners are good, you know, green friendly people that want to reduce carbon. It's because they're getting huge benefits out of that. And so we tried to tackle that. It's the reason why you saw a 12% increase. CMP applied to the PUC for another 12 to 13% increase. It's because of this net energy billing. And the more of these that go online, the higher the electric rates get. And this is going to continue. These electric rates are going to continue to skyrocket for a long ways to come if we don't get a grip on it. And we had a bill that would have done that. And unfortunately, it was rejected completely along party lines.
Kevin?
Yeah, hi, Representative. So we've heard a lot of complaints this session, particularly from Republicans, about process and a perceived lack of transparency. So late filed bills, concept drafts, mm-hmm. which are vague two-line bills without any actual content, you know, public hearings that were scheduled very quickly. I think we've all been around this place for a while, and these aren't necessarily new issues, particularly when it comes to, I'd say, transparency in the budget drafting process. But I definitely had a sense that you and other Republicans felt it was worse this year. So I guess my question is, if Republicans were to win control next session, you know, how would you go about changing that? And what would you do to make sure to address these process issues that you guys talked a lot about this session?
Yeah, definitely. We have to have public notice on bills. We can't be introducing amendments, you know, right before committee meetings and things of that nature. You need to have transparency. You need to have your meetings in the daylight. If they're going to be big amendments that are going to make huge changes, you can't be having them at 3 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, it was Republicans that were making the outcry on that. But one of the ways you know we're right is because Democrats agreed with us. You saw even Ann Perry, who put in the controversial LD 227 bill, even agreed that it seemed sneaky and it wasn't right and it wasn't a good process to do that. And I don't know if that amendment ever did become open to the public, because as of the day of the public hearing, it still wasn't public. And even after the public hearing, it still wasn't available on the website. People were having to pass around a Google Doc to share with people what was in the bill. So we would love to get an opportunity to govern. I'd really like to see the Maine people give us a shot. I think we're deserving of it, especially the way this session has gone. So many things that the Maine people need haven't been addressed. In the last three legislatures, the size of state government has increased from $7 billion to almost $10.5 billion. Energy costs keep skyrocketing. And like I said, it's not a product of natural gas or some foreign war or some, you know, mysterious thing. It's this net energy billing that we have done to ourselves. It's a law that we put in the Maine legislature that's making these electric rates go up, because they should be going down. The price of natural gas has gone down. And we're not even talking about getting good, clean sources of energy like hydro out of Canada and many other options that we could be looking into to lower energy costs. So these are really products of our own doing at state level.
Very good. Appreciate your time. House Republican Leader Billy Bob Falkingham, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on, you guys.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. Our phone number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our topic today, the key issues that were addressed during the legislative session and what's ahead. My guests are Susan Cover, a digital journalist with Spectrum News Maine, Kevin Miller, State House correspondent with Maine Public, and Steve Missler, chief politics and government correspondent for Maine Public. Share your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or just give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. A couple more things that did pass this session that we want to get into before we turn to the failed effort. Susan, was a $2 million in annual funding for more than 20 recovery centers in Maine. It doesn't seem like a lot of money, but clearly it's an issue. The substance issue continues to just to be a major thing here in the state of Maine. And this, is in one attempt to get at that.
Yes, the opioid epidemic does continue in Maine, although statistics show last year there was a fairly significant decrease in the number of overdose deaths. But certainly there's an effort to provide more services for people who find themselves in a crisis with substance use disorder and to get those services out in all parts of the state, not just maybe in our major population centers like Portland, but to make sure that people can get timely access to care when they need it, when they find that they are really struggling with substance use disorder.
Kevin, there is a tribal bill that we saw which gives the courts, tribal courts, authority to prosecute serious offenses. How significant is this in the sort of overall landscape of the I guess the sort of the sovereignty issues that the tribes are most concerned about?
Yeah, it's absolutely part of this broader sovereignty push that tribal members and leaders have been making for several years now. It was part of the report that came out of this task force that looked at improving Maine's relationship with the tribes several years ago. Obviously, they've been pushing for these broader tribal sovereignty bills for the past several years. They have not been able to get those through or get them by Governor Mills. But she worked with the tribes on this issue, which is kind of a criminal justice reform area. This bill in particular deals with Class C, D, and E crimes. These are, you know, D and E crimes are misdemeanors. Class C is kind of the lowest level of felony offense. And what it would allow, as I understand it, is it would allow tribal courts to assume total jurisdiction over these crimes if they're committed on tribal territory or by tribal members. And in a case where a crime is committed by a non-tribal member on tribal territory, the tribes and state courts would have concurrent jurisdiction. So it's a way, the way the tribes describe it, it's a way for them to take back some of these criminal justice issues that they feel have been taken away from them by the state, when at least some of the tribes, not all of them, but some of the tribes have tribal court systems in place to be able to handle them.
Kevin, I'll stay with you. Because you covered also this this other proposal which passed, which was a SHIELD law protecting healthcare workers who provide gender affirming care. Just quickly, the background there and what it does.
Yeah, so this all comes out of the Supreme Court decision on Roe versus Wade. It's kind of an outgrowth of that. Maine already has some protections for medical professionals who provide abortions to women from other states where abortions are banned or access is restricted. That came from an executive order. What this bill would do is it would apply those protections for healthcare workers providing reproductive care or gender-affirming care to people from other states that come to Maine. And it's pretty much aimed, it's called a SHIELD law because it's aiming to protect those providers from lawsuits or prosecutions from other states where they've said, you know, if you go to another state, we're going to go after you or we're going to go after those doctors. And we've seen a little bit of that since Roe versus Wade. So it's a way to, again, kind of shield those healthcare providers from these lawsuits. And Maine is not unique. There are more than a dozen states that have these sorts of SHIELD laws for abortion providers, and in some cases, gender-affirming care. The gender-affirming care part of it received the most attention this time because that's, you know, we're talking about transgender rights, and that's become a it's become part of the culture wars here in Maine and across the country.
We will turn to what wasn't passed here momentarily, but I do want to bring in a call. We'll talk with Rocco, who's calling from Fort Fairfield. Hi, Rocco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
My question is, I know a law was passed about bump stocks and triggers. I own a binary trigger, and I'm wondering what to expect. Am I meant to turn this in? Should I expect the ATF at my door? Is it even covered in this ban? Thank you.
Yeah, Rocco, thank you. I'm not sure if any of our panelists would be the one to ask, but Kevin, well, you covered this mostly, so.
I'm not familiar. This is Steve.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm not familiar with the binary trigger. Does it make the gun fire as if it's a automatic weapon or something similar?
No, by the current definition of a trigger pull, it fires once on the pull and once on the release, so it's two movements of the finger. It meets the ATF definition of semi-automatic, but I know it's on the chopping block. It's one that people want to ban because, I don't know, it makes the gun scarier.
Yeah, I'm not certain whether the bill that passed, it hasn't been signed yet, by the way, so we're not sure if it will even be affected, if that ban will go into effect. It depends on whether the governor signs it or not, but I can't speak to whether or not that particular device on your firearm would be affected under this.
I'm sure people have a lot of questions about how this all plays out. But still, here on the gun front, as we turn to measures that didn't pass, as we mentioned, the red flag law did not pass. Also, there's a gun-related proposal that received less attention, and this would have studied the potential creation of a process in which Mainers who have been prohibited from having a gun due to, for example, nonviolent felonies could apply to have their ownership rights restored. So this was even just a study bill, and it did not pass. Kevin, what can we say about that?
Yeah, this bill definitely didn't receive a lot of attention amongst these more contentious issues. I mean, there actually were other bills in that dealt with ways to allow somebody to voluntarily give up their rights to own a gun if they are potentially in a suicidal situation. So, you know, there were, like I said, there were a number of firearms-related bills that just didn't get a lot of attention, largely because they got overshadowed by these much more prominent bills that we saw, that we've been talking about.
Also, this measure that was much discussed to separate the Child Welfare Office from the Department of Health and Human Services, Susan, there's a lot of attention paid to that. And that really, didn't happen?
No, it didn't. And this has come up in previous legislatures and has gotten bipartisan support in the Senate, and then seems to go to the House to languish. I think the feeling this time around is that the former head of the Office of Child and Family Services resigned in November and was replaced by his top lieutenant. And I think there was a sense that maybe she should be given time to see if she can prove herself. Also, there's a lot more money going toward hiring more caseworkers and caseworker aides, giving them more mentoring and more training, and an overall feeling that maybe some of the reforms that have been put in place need a little bit of time to work to see if this can be a better system to keep our children safe in Maine. And I'd imagine if we see that that's not happening in the next legislative session, there'll be another bill in to separate out that Child and Family Services away from the larger umbrella organization of DHS.
Steve, I know you covered that issue as well. Is there any impression that you have from what happened there?
No, the only thing I think Susan did a great job of explaining sort of the dynamics there. But the takeaway that I had from it was that there was a lot of frustration directed at the child welfare. It's actually the Office of Child and Family Services. A lot of frustration, a lot of public hearings and work sessions by the Government Oversight Committee, which is sort of the watchdog of the legislature. And, you know, they spent all of last fall and a good part of last summer meeting to talk about the problems at this office. And, you know, what they didn't really sort of coalesce behind was many solutions. This proposal that would basically separate out the child welfare division from DHHS is ultimately where they landed. That seemed to be the only place where there was a coalescing of ideas. Unfortunately, you know, there was still a lot of ambivalence about it because, you know, it wasn't clear like what the like physically separating these two agencies, what that would do to alleviate some of the problems, which are systemic and societal in some cases. And so there was just, I think, some reservations about standing up a new agency, which would have cost, I think, something like $9 million to just get it started, and whether or not that would even address the problem. So I think that that argument, along with probably the governor's, you know, opposition to it, may have doomed its fate.
Kevin, another issue that has sort of emerged every year and has just not managed to get traction is this effort to ban the sale of flavored tobacco products, which supporters have argued is really needed to because it's it seems to be targeted to younger users. What happened there again?
Yeah, this is a bill that's come up year after year, at least past couple sessions. It actually came pretty close to passing. I believe it passed the Senate chamber last year, but they weren't able to get it over the finish line. Again, there was a lot of attention to the bill at the committee level. There were a number of press conferences. And, you know, as you mentioned, the supporters of this bill, they say this is important to trying to reduce child use of tobacco and nicotine products. But again, they just couldn't get it over the finish line. And I think instead we've seen a shift towards focusing on local ordinances at the town level to try to address this issue. They came back to the State House again, hoping to have more success this time. But again, they weren't able to. So I fully expect that we'll see towns continue to take up this issue.
Susan, a lot of attention and time was spent on the issue of data privacy, but again, which one would think would be a popular initiative, but that went nowhere.
Yeah, it did, and boy, talk about the time spent by the Judiciary Committee on two competing bills, one from a Democrat and one from a Republican. Both came forward and neither ended up going anywhere. You know, this is a national issue. This is an issue that we would hope maybe would affect large companies, but there was a lot of concern that it would also affect small Maine companies and their ability to gather customer service data in their marketing efforts. So again, you know, this is another one that I'm sure will come back around next year.
Yes, Steve, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the way Sue pointed out that they held something like 14 work sessions on that particular proposal. And the one observation I had was that it seemed to me that there were two, basically there was the internet like Apple and some of the businesses that would be affected by this, by the shielding of customer data. And then there was the ACLU of Maine, which was, you know, they're big on privacy, on consumer privacy. And so these two groups were basically crafting separate bills that were being advanced in the legislature. And I think the Judiciary Committee at one point tried to marry them together, but then I think realized that there's just some fundamental tensions between what these two bills tried to do. And they just were at odds with one another. And it just seemed like, you know, it was a victim of the process, which is a shame because I know they put the members of that committee and, of course, the analysts who do a lot of work around here and don't get recognized for it. You know, they spent a lot of time on that bill only to see it, you know, not go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I'll just add, Kevin here, I'll just add real quickly that what Steve and Sue just mentioned, one of the challenges here is that they spent so much time in committee, and then this bill hit the floor on the last couple of days of the session. And I don't think lawmakers understood what they were voting on because so much of the time was spent in committee.
Sure. And they ran out of time. And we are out of time. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us today. Appreciate it. Susan Kober, a digital journalist with Spectrum News Maine. Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent. And Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. Maine Public is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or listen to past programs. And for those of you who have signed up for the newsletter, you're eligible to win a mystery book bundle. Tomorrow on the program, decision time for many high school seniors heading off to college in the fall. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.